And hey, hi everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon or this evening. We're delighted to have Nina Simon with us. She's going to be talking about her book, Mother-Daughter Murder Night. And I understand that was probably your mom off screen there, right? Okay. And this book
you can invite her to join us if you want.
I mean, I really tried.
And the book is getting so much attention and so much buzz. Congratulations, Nina.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored to be with you all today and just so excited about this journey and the story.
Yeah. And so we're actually doing two events for Nina. We're doing this virtual event, kind of pre-pub, as it were. The book doesn't come out until September 5th. But I'm going to go ahead and also I'm going to go ahead and put a buy link in the comments field, and you can go ahead and pre-order your autographed copy. Nina will be here on September 7th to sign copies. And I think we'll have to figure out, Barbara, are we going to do another virtual component to that event? We might as well, because these conversations take slightly different tone, with the live audience. So anyway, if you have questions for Nina, go ahead and put them in the comments field on YouTube or Facebook, and I'll be delighted to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Hi, Nina. What a pleasure it is to meet you. Thank you for joining us. I'll give you just a little background. Why are we doing this weird thing? And it goes back to 2018 when a book called Where the Crawdads Sing published, and I had a little tussle with the publisher about whether the author should come and sign her book for us. And I didn't. I ordered a lot, but I didn't order nearly as many as I probably could have, and I have regretted that. So when I read Nina's book, I felt I was, to some degree, revisiting elements of Crawdads that I like a lot. For example, they are Elkhorn Slough. It's not Slough, it's Slough. Is that just right? And so I thought we should really order a lot of these. But here was our problem. I wanted it to be an August 1st Mystery Club book because we have a club that does that. And the publisher was okay with letting us have copies early and shipping some to Nina to sign for us. But then other things happened and the publication date had to be affirmed September 5th, meaning we could go ahead and only sell this book to our club members in August, but we can't let anybody else have it till September. Plus, we ordered so many more that it wouldn't be fair for Nina to have an avalanche of cartons of books to send upon her defenseless self at home. So our policy is if we're up more than 200 books, we figure out some way to get the author to the bookstore because it's just a nightmare otherwise to do it. And that's why we're having two books. Is that enough for you, Nina? Does that now make it clear?
Absolutely. Well, and on Instagram, I'm Nina K. Simon, and I shared a video of me trying to haul the 80 books you did send for the book club up the hill in flip-flops. I live in the woods, and so it was quite an effort just to be able to get those books for your club, which I'm so glad I was able to do. And I'm so excited to be with you in person next week.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you had an early illustration of, what it's like. But anyway, as you can gather, I'm really excited about this book. And I was excited about the book before Indie Next Pick and other good things that are happening to Nina occurred. So I'd like to, one of the things we think we do really well at the Poison Pen is to spot new talent and to acquaint you with debut novels. I think we're really good at it. We're going to be 34 years old. I wish I were, but the store will be on October 3rd. So we have a pretty good record, all things considered. So I hope that's a good luck charm for you, Nina.
Oh, this whole experience of writing this book and the publishing journey has felt very much like a good luck charm. So I'm honored to be here.
Wonderful. Why don't you tell us, if you'd like to, what your journey was, and you can edit it down if it's too long a version.
So Mother-Daughter Murder Night is an intergenerational mystery. It's both a family drama and a traditional murder mystery about three generations of women. There's a grandma, there's a single mom, and a teenage girl who work together to solve this murder in this marine preserve, Elkhorn Slough, where they live. And I never expected to write this novel, let alone any novel. But then almost 3 years ago now, my mom, who, like the main character, is a tough, feisty LA Jewish businesswoman and a very young, hip grandma, got sick. She got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and it changed my life. I made some big changes to be able to go to Los Angeles and be with her and support her through treatment. And we were very lucky to be together during that time. But it was also a time of a lot of stress, and frankly, also a lot of conversations that were only about one thing. And talking about cancer all the time is not very fun. Talking about protein shakes is certainly not fun. And my mom and I have both always loved murder mysteries. And so one day when we were together having another argument about a protein shake, probably, we just realized we needed something else to talk about. And I turned to her and I said, you know, what if I tried writing a murder mystery with someone like you as the lead detective? And, you know, at the time, I didn't think, oh, I'm writing this so that it would become this book. You know, I thought, we are going to have a project and something that can be an escape for us, something that can be joyful for us, and something that I can put some of my energy into while I'm doing this caregiving and support for my mom. And so we started on this journey where in the mornings while she slept, I would sit next to her on her bed and type on the laptop. And then when she woke up, I would pass her the scene I'd written and go make breakfast. And we'd talk about it. And we really developed these characters together. My mom helped a lot with the research. And this project was about us having a connection and us having this escape. And then, of course, what happened is as I kept writing, as my mom kept giving me notes, we both realized maybe this was bigger than just our little fantasy and our little escape. And I started to feel that this might be the next path I was going to take professionally, and certainly creatively. I was all in, and it was for my mom and I, this gift, this new center to our conversations, where yes, of course, we were still talking about her treatment and her healing. And fortunately, my mom's on a very good trajectory right now. But this book became a world we could escape to that we chose and that I could create based on the conversations we were having.
That's an amazing story. I'm so thankful that your mom is on a good trajectory. Cancer is no longer necessarily a death sentence, although, you know, that's we right. all panic at the very thought of the word. I have several reactions, but let me start with an easy one, which is, describe to us where Elkhorn Slough is located.
Yeah, so Elkhorn Slough is in Monterey Bay. And when you think about Monterey Bay, it's a sea. Santa Cruz, where I live, is at the top. Monterey and Carmel is at the bottom. Big Sur is down here. And then you're headed south to Los Angeles about 4 hours from there. So Elkhorn Slough is right in the middle. And it is actually the second biggest estuary in California after the San Francisco Bay. So that means that you're driving along the highway, along Highway 1, you know, which is the iconic highway that runs along the coast of California. And you get to the spot where there is a marina, there's an old power plant with big towers, you're on a freeway, there's railroad, but then you look to the right and you see the ocean, you look to the left and you see this river snaking up into these agricultural hills. You see otters, you see egrets, you see pelicans. It's an incredible home of wildlife and nature, and it's smashed up against a very active human environment as well. And I always find that, you know, places that are on the edge of two worlds, whether it be nature and, you know, human commerce, whether it be urban, rural, are often places where there's interesting friction, and interesting friction can mean conflict, and conflict can sometimes mean crime. So I've always loved Elkhorn Slough, both as a place I love to go to for peace and relaxation, but it's a spooky place. There is, you know, the fog sits very thick there. And then you also have all these old abandoned farm shacks and these, you know, snaking little creeks that go to mysterious places and shark hunting blinds and all kinds of kind of rich, juicy spots for a murder to happen.
Well, coastal California has changed a lot. My Stanford roommate lived in Monterey. So we used to go up and down when you drove to Saratoga, and then you split off and went down Highway 1 and hoped that you didn't have a landslide, which happened to me at least once. Up and go all the way back up to El Camino and, you know, go south. And of course, you know, it was more agricultural then than it is now. Monterey Bay is amazing. You know, you can play golf or you can go to the incredible aquarium. And, you know, Monterey and Carmel are they're almost anomalies. I mean, they're so special themselves. And then, you know, to go past, as you say, the slough. I've always thought that the industrial towers were, you know, remarkable.
Well, they are. And actually, I'd love to do a mystery there, because it's such an interesting thing that you have these two power plant towers right on the ocean, and they are decommissioned now. But one of the reasons they're still there, I talked to a lot of wildlife ecologists as I was working on this book, is that there are nesting raptors who love to nest at the top of those towers. And so now they've become kind of a natural resource to the wildlife and the environment. And it's one of the reasons the towers haven't been taken down, which is so wild. And you're right, you know, Elkhorn Slough is on the north side of Monterey County. So it's not the wealthy Carmel golf course part, although that part plays a little bit of a role in this story, but it really is the agricultural, you know, Salinas is called the salad bowl of America. And if you buy organic strawberries or bagged lettuce, it probably comes from just a few miles from where this book is set. And actually, you know, this winter, the area where Elkhorn Slough is was in the national news because it was a site of tremendous and terrible flooding in the Pajaro Valley, where thousands of people, mostly, you know, Latino migrant farm workers, lost their homes to flooding.
Right. But I mean, if you've got Santa Cruz here and you've got, you know, it's an area where, as you say, there are lots of people with lots of money. It's so close to it that inevitably, I mean, we see here in Scottsdale, you know, this constant creeping growth out into the desert. We don't have enough water for all the developers. Every day there's word of like some new developer and so forth. So Elkhorn Slough, you know, needs a lot of protection if it's going to remain anything like it is. So, you know, plot points. But anyway, it's a gorgeous space. The California coast, I think. You know, California was never actually designed by nature and by geography, especially Southern California, for the number of people that live there. I mean, if you build up on a mountain in Arizona, you're on hard rock, you're on granite. If you do it in Los Angeles, you're, you know, you're on sandstone and crumbly stuff, and no wonder it all slides, you know. Away. I know my father talked to me because he traveled out there in the 30s before the war, which really changed Southern California tremendously, about how beautiful it was, how agricultural it was, and so forth. So remnants like Elkhorn Slough, I think, are, you know, really, really valuable.
Very special. Yeah. And as you're saying, you know, California, and really the heart of the mystery in this book, has to do with land, right? It has to do with a ranch adjacent to Elkhorn Slough and many different stakeholders arguing about what should this land be used for. And I think that these are very real conversations in coastal California about agriculture, about housing, about venture capitalists coming in because the land is so valuable. And so I think that one of the things I wanted to explore in this book through the mystery a little bit is this question about how do we think about the different paths historically of land in California and in the future, and where we want to take our land.
Absolutely. And how can we preserve it? You know, how much can it become state or federal land? What does it take to make it a monument? You know, we just have one declared here in Arizona by President Biden up around Grand Canyon, for example. You know, I mean, it's an ongoing conversation as resources are dwindling and the number of people are going up. So you're right. It's crime, you know, crime fiction depends on conflict. And I've always loved the Sarah Paretsky line. I think it was Sarah, or maybe I just use it to talk about Sarah, that crime fiction cuts along the edge of social change and along, you know, social conflict. And I think the best novels, best crime stories anyway, do have that underpinning, you know, of real issues. It isn't just, you know, a kind of convenient plot or something, but there are serious issues and conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've talked about Lamb, we've talked about cancer, mm-hmm. And we've talked about family. But if your mom is listening, no offense here, Mom, but I have to say that one of the reasons I like this book the best was the completely outrageous nature of the grandmother. My mother was tough on her, you know. She could clear a room, but I don't know that I've run across anybody quite like Lana before. You want to describe it, but the interplay between Lana and Beth and Jack is really remarkable. But Lana, I think, is really the driving force among the three characters. Beth tends to react to her. Jack is so young. What is she, like 15?
That's right.
Yeah, so she's, you know, she's not even a fully formed adult yet. She's trying to kind of figure out things. So Lena's really the engine here. So
absolutely.
Is your mom okay with that?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I would say more than any other notes, and maybe she's sharing in the chat, I don't know, but more than anything else, my mom and I spent a lot of time talking about Lena Rubicon and about how to portray her, how to walk the line of some of her rougher edges in a way that still gave her a path to love and connection with her daughter and her granddaughter, but was also real to this very tough, very judgmental, very fierce woman. And I think I had a blast writing her and felt like I could write her with love, because I feel like I grew up around a lot of, you know, fiery, strong Jewish women, who many of whom were single moms and who were fighting hard to be able to make a life for themselves in male-dominated industries, you know, making careers for themselves, but also to create opportunities for their daughters. And certainly my mom did that for me and my sister as well. And, you know, it's funny because Lana, no question, she's the star of this book. And actually, in the first draft, the focus was much more focused on Lana specifically. And it was really working with my editor, William Morrow, Liz Stein, who really pushed me to expand Beth, her daughter, and Jack, her granddaughter, to be, if not Lana's equals in the story, to be real partners in the sleuthing that happens. And I think that there's a very practical reason for this, which is when you have an amateur sleuth, of course, they can't, you know, check out everything. They can't go everywhere. So it's nice to have some buddies in crime solving. But also I think that Lana is so outrageous and that's so fun. But it doesn't necessarily make her the easiest character to identify with. And I think that one of the things I've had a lot of fun with early readers, and I'd love to hear this from folks once you read the book, you know, which Rubicon woman do you identify with? Because I really hear different things from different people. And sometimes it's generational. People will say, oh, I'm Beth, I'm sandwiched between, you know, my aging parent and the child I'm trying to raise. But sometimes people will talk more personality based, you know, certainly I think that my mom and I joke about the fact that I like to say that all the good parts of Lana are based on her and all the bad parts are based on me. You know, that I think that I have experienced as a woman who, before I started writing novels, was a nonprofit CEO, was really pushing all the time, that kind of impatience, that kind of selfishness. And also I think, you know, Lana is somebody who's incredibly independent. And I think her path in the book in a lot of ways is figuring out that it's not always a source of weakness to rely on somebody else. And I think that, you know, in some ways that mirrored when my own mom got sick. She and I and my sister all love each other, and we're all really independent women. And for us, it was a big change to express our love, not in a, you're strong and good and doing your thing in your city, and I'm strong and good and doing my thing in my city, but really transitioning to this kind of interconnected caregiving for each other. And I feel like Beth is the character I learned the most from as I was writing this book, because I started out feeling like I don't know how to be a good caregiver. And Beth is a nurse. She's loving. She's, you know, very honorable and strong and self-sacrificing. And when I started writing this book, I admired people like that, but I didn't understand them in any way because I identified much more with the hard charging my way or the highway Lana. And I think that for me, there was a lot of learning about how to embrace the Beth inside of me as I was writing this book.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm clearly a Lana, so we can talk about that. But what, I mean, you know, let's start with Lana. Okay. So mm-hmm. here she's been, she's clawed her way up to be a hugely successful real estate broker in Los Angeles. She's made tons of money. She has great connections, great social connections. She's a real power figure. And then not only does she lose her health, but she also loses her money and her business. So she, everything about her that made her who she was is suddenly imploded.
Yeah, and I would say even more important to her, she loses her independence and she loses her power. And I think that I wrote Lana really thinking about a lot of women I know, maybe my age and older, who talk about feeling invisible or feeling that they are becoming invisible as they get older. And I think that Lana has worked her entire life to be seen, to have power and agency, and to not be discarded or made invisible. And I think that when she gets sick, I think there's even a line in there somewhere about, becoming irrelevant was even more terrifying than the prospect of dying. And I think that for Lana, yes, she's lost her job. Yes, she's lost her home in Los Angeles, but even more, she's lost her freedom and her ability to be this powerful woman who is highly seen in the world. And I think that that is what drives her the most bananas as she lies there in bed in her daughter's ramshackle cottage up in Elkhorn Slough.
Well, I think you're right. And I think that for most people, the trajectory is as you get older, you know, you become more vulnerable, your health begins mm-hmm. to, you know, possibly fade. And it's easier to accept it if it's gradual rather than it happens in the rather abrupt way mm-hmm. it happens. Lana, I, on the other hand, to be personal, was sort of like Beth in my 40s, and then I turned into Lana in my 50s. And now that I'm 82, almost 83, I'm probably even worse than Lana. So my trajectory has been the inverse.
Oh, that's so interesting.
You'll be, you know, I also married into a very famous Jewish family. I'm a Rosenwald by marriage. Huh. So I've learned much about what you're talking about through, again, as I've aged. But my children have had to cope with this transition. And I think it's been slightly confusing for them to watch mom get more like Lana instead of less like Lana.
I think you should. Time. I mean, why yep. the heck not, you know? And well, and frankly, yeah, I mean, you know this, but you look amazing. I never would have guessed. And it's funny, actually, you know, Lana in the book is 57. My mom is 74. And when I first started writing this book, she was 72 and I wrote the character as 72. And then, in discussion, my mom really felt like, for people to care about this character, she's got to be younger. And so we made her 62. And then when I had an agent, my agent said, we need her to be a little younger. And so I'm like looking up all these famous actresses online. And Sandra Bullock, at the time I was writing it, was 57. And I was like, that's it. This character cannot be younger than Sandra Bullock. Like, you know, there are so many women who have so much power, much beyond even the age of Lana. I think, you know, it's something that I'm actually really excited that I feel like there are more and more books with older protagonists.
It's becoming a thing in crime fiction. There's a wonderful book called Mrs. Plansky's Revenge. I cannot, I'll give you one when you come to see us.
Thank you.
Mrs. Klinsky, an elderly Jewish woman in Florida whose children are to some degree fleecing her, is fleeced by a Romanian and heads to Romania when nobody else will help her in order to recover her money.
That sounds fun.
Fabulous story. It really is. So I have children older than Lana, which also is kind of a weird thing for me. But anyway, Beth is where she is in part because she made some choices. Not always happy ones when she was younger. Mm-hmm. And so in part, her life has been to learn to accept the consequences of choices she made and of being a single parent. mm-hmm. and so forth. So that's, you know, a very different story, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that, you know, both Lana and Beth became single moms to some extent, and at not too dissimilar ages, but under very different circumstances. And they reacted to that situation very differently. And I think that, you know, Beth is somebody who escaped Los Angeles to get out of her mother's control and shadow, but also to have a life that Lana might see as quite small, but involves a lot of beauty, a lot of connection to nature, and a very deep connection to her daughter, Jack, as well. And so I think that, you know, a lot of the book is not about one of them, Lana or Beth, convincing the other one that they're right, but about two women who are strong in very different ways, learning to respect and negotiate and love each other for the different kind of strength and the different kind of choices that they've made, which I feel like is never easy in relationships, and maybe particularly in mother-daughter relationships. I think that Beth is somebody who actually, of all the characters, she's the one, you know, I said I learned most from, but also did the most redrafting through to really make sure that her life felt full and didn't feel like, oh, poor Beth, you know, she has these consequences she has to live with, but instead to think, wow, you know, this woman has made a life that she's really defining on her own two feet, even if it's very different than what many people might choose.
It's a life she's happy with, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, she is. Everybody measures success differently, that's you right. know. And the yardstick for Beth is quite different than the yardstick for Lana. So then, at the bottom of this, you know, is Jack, yeah. who you know is living with her mother Beth, and they have a life that they both value. And then suddenly, crashing in upon them, is Lana, who not only, you know, is so different, but also is very needy. Even if she doesn't want to be,
yeah,
because you know, here she is with cancer, and you know, treatment is required, or maybe you know, will she just give up, or is she going to actually? And then on top of all this, Jack finds a body.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And yeah, and Jack is this combination. What? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, for Jack, you know, she's already had this load sort of dropped upon her, you know, and then suddenly she finds a body. And by finding a body, as everybody knows who reads crime fiction, the person who finds the body becomes a suspect, right? It's yeah. just, you know, that's the way it works.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And I think that Jack, you know, at 15 is very adventurous. And at the beginning of the story, is starting to itch a little bit against the smallness of the world that she and Beth share. But then her world becomes much bigger in ways that she would not have chosen or guessed, you know, namely her grandmother taking over her room and she's moving to the couch, and then finding this dead body and getting embroiled in this murder investigation. And so, you know, it's funny, I have a daughter, Rocket, who's 10 now. She was 7 when I started working on this book. And I like to think that Jack is the kind of teenager that I hope Rocket will grow up to become like. I mean, my daughter is already a real outdoor adventurer, but I think of Jack as somebody who is adventurous, but very responsible and really ready to pitch in and root for her family and for her mother and grandmother to form a kind of relationship and to form a real relationship and one that is no longer estranged, and not necessarily in a saccharine way, but I think that, you know, Jack has had this world that is just her and her mother and this beautiful marine preserve where they live, which I guess is kind of, yeah, a crawdad's connection in that way. But when Lana comes, I think Jack is very generous to look at it as something that opens up her world as opposed to something that takes over her world in a way that she is not possibly open to.
Well, I think we have to remember that while Beth chose a smaller life away from Jack, didn't get to choose that. That's what Jack has grown up in. And so it's almost inevitable that, you know, she's going to want to expand those boundaries, even though it may cause her, you know, to regret some of the things that she could lose or to worry about some things sure. that she could lose. So yeah. it's kind of an inverse dynamic, you know, with Beth.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
children right. don't get to choose the place, you know, that they are yeah. living and the people around them. And she's 15 is one of those kind of pivotal ages, you know, it used mm-hmm. to be. And I think in France, it may still be, or maybe just became the age of consent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. when people lived shorter lives, girls got married at 13, sure. they were moms by sure. 15. And, you know, here's Jack.
Well, my best friend is a high school ninth grade sex ed teacher. And so she actually helped me a lot in thinking about where is Jack at developmentally to think about some of these identity challenges she has around, you know, not knowing her father, being a biracial girl who, you know, is not connected to one side of her identity through family. And then also just, you know, developmentally, how do you deal when these major things come into your life? You know, when you're a teenager, everything is an 11 on the scale of drama. And certainly finding a dead body is way off the charts in a lot of that way.
So there is a murder, and that does bring in what? Police, yes. or at least authorities. Maybe it's the sheriff. I'm trying to remember. I think where you are is probably a sheriff.
Sheriffs, that's right. Sheriff's right. deputies.
Yeah. Those of you who are sophisticated in crime fiction know that sheriffs are counties, and police are towns and cities and villages and so forth. But anyway, authorities. And there have to be other suspects, especially if Jack is going to not be, you know, well, we don't know whether Jack is actually the killer or not. We don't even know if there was a motive. We don't know if there's more than one suspicious death. There are a whole lot of things that have to unfold. So, you know, one of the reasons I like this book better than Crawdads is the plot makes a lot more sense. It really does. I love the girl and I love the nature in Crawdads. I have to say, I never saw that kind of success coming to a book that I think is beautiful but still flawed. And so maybe, you know, I kind of adapted Mother-Daughter Murder Night as a oh. as a different version. I mean,
I'll take it.
And you know, I have a lovely photo of Delia sitting in our store, you know, signing copies, and every time I see it I think why didn't I order thousands? But the answer is that I really didn't see it coming. And mm-hmm. I wonder how many people at the very beginning, you know, had any idea. Mm-hmm. And if you do this long enough, in our case, nearly 34 years, what you know is you just can't predict it.
Sure.
You know, there is a trajectory that could take off the Da Vinci Code, you know, Twilight. I mean, Twilight, she lives here. You know, we did an event for her and her publisher said, you really ought to have more books than you've ordered. And I thought, why? So, I mean, you know, we're really good when we're good, but sometimes yeah. you just don't see it. It may not be to your own taste or it may be so different. And every time you get a book that's a wild success, you get clones. It kind of resets things and it starts a trend. And so you get more books where nature is involved. Mm. After Crawdads, after the Da Vinci Code, there were like 3 years of Da Vinci clones. We got nothing but religious conspiracy thriller because publishers tend to follow, you know, market demand. And, you know, it's, you're now far enough away from 2018. This is 5 years on, you know, sure. that I don't think anyone can say, oh, look, you know, it's a Crawdads clone or, you know, we're in that trend. I think we've moved on that trend.
Well, first of all, if you're making any predictions that this book could be a tenth of the success of that kind of book, you know, I'll take it. But
I don't know that any book.
Yeah, of course. Like how do you know? But I will say that, you know, when I signed with my agent, one of the, I think the nice things about what you're describing is that for authors, or at least for debut authors, I didn't even know there were trends, you know, in terms of I was writing the book that I thought would make my mom smile. I was writing the book that I wanted to read. My mom and I have always been fans of traditional mysteries. You know, Faye Kellerman has been a big person in our life, my life growing up, you know, which is, of course, an Orthodox Jewish woman and an Irish cop in Los Angeles, which is where I grew up and we're a Jewish family. But when I signed with my agent, she said, you know, this could be a very hard book to sell because it's kind of partly a family drama and partly a mystery. And, you know, she was saying domestic suspense and these thrillers have been very successful. I'm not sure where this is going to sit. And then, of course, we got unbelievably lucky that Thursday Murder Club, Finley Donovan, Vera Wong, you know, that they're started, The Maid, that they're over the last couple of years have been these books that are these traditional mysteries with some humor, with some warm-heartedness, and that, you know, it became possible for a book like Mother Daughter Murder Night to sell very quickly to a publisher, which I'm so grateful for. And, you know, people have sent me pictures of this book next to Benjamin Stevenson's book, Everybody in My Family Has Killed Someone. You know, there are even these titles that are kind of related, this idea around family and around coziness and murder. And I actually wonder if in some ways that's a reaction to the pandemic, because, you know, I wrote this book in response and in the context of my mom's illness, but it was also a time when a lot of people were struggling with a lot of different crises around, you know, what was happening in 2020 and 2021. And at least for me, that sent me as a reader back to books that were a comfort for me. And for me, that's traditional crime fiction. You know, it is Sue Grafton, it is Janet Ivanovich, it's Faye Kellerman, it's old Don Winslow. And I think that this idea of a comfortable, you know, it's so odd in some ways to think murder and comfort might go together. But of course, you know, Louise Penny is the queen of this, right? And so I think that at least for me, this was a time when I was seeking something that was lighter, that was warm-hearted at its core, even if there was going to be murder and crime happening. And I think that, you know, there is a mini trend around that, that I'm so grateful that Mother Daughter Murder Night can, you know, to some extent contribute to or be part of.
If we have a trend at the moment, it actually is towards sort of cross-genre books.
Mm.
You know, it's always the unexpected that takes off. You know, I'll tell you a story about the Da Vinci Code when you're here. I'm not going to say it right here. And it's the same thing with crawdads. You know, again, it's the unpredictable book that resets everything. We're just like another book, you know. It doesn't have any, and it's fascinating to, you know, I have to read, or at least go through, a couple of hundred books a month. There are 288 hardcover adult fiction novels published every week at this point. I've been getting statistics that I do my best to cover maybe 200 a month. There are many that, you know, I'm not interested in. I try not to follow trends. I mean, anybody can go to Barnes & Noble, you know, and pick up a trend or something. So we try very hard. Patrick reads, we all read, we try to figure it out. And it's, you know, it's the unexpected that grabs you, but at the same time, you really can't tell it's going to grab anybody else. What I've learned in 34 years is to trust me. You know, if I like it, because the first time I wrote a newsletter, I remember saying to my husband, why will anyone care? I really did. You know, it's like, why will anyone care what I think about this book? And I had no, I mean, and gradually it's turned out that people do care, because people, it's such an overwhelming universe of books that people are interested in guidance, whether it's a book club, whether it's, you know, fellow readers, whether it's, you know, the staff, whatever it is. But it's always, it's almost impossible to navigate the large field of books anymore. So, you know, we are influencers. We're not on TikTok. Well, I'm never going to be on TikTok.
Never say never, Barbara.
No, others than the staff can do TikTok. Yeah. I mean, but anyway, you know, it does require a level of confidence in yourself, in you know, in going forth and saying to people, this is a book I loved, and here's why I think you will love it too. And, you know,
I'm just honored. I'm honored you felt that way. Well, and to be honest, I always thought I was a great reader until when I started writing, I realized, gosh, I am only reading books that show up on certain lists or get reviewed in certain newspapers. And as I started reading more widely in crime fiction, I started seeking out, you know, people like you, entities like Poisoned Pen, some of the blogs that are out there, because I realized I am only scratching the surface of the amazing diversity of stories that are out there. You know, I've gotten very into reading mysteries that really involve a deep family story as well. And I just read this book, Saint X, that came out a couple of years ago. And there was a great book called Whatever Happened to Ruthie Ramirez by Claire Jimenez that I loved. And these are books I did not discover on my own. It's only because of people like you out there who are calling attention to these books. And so I'm so grateful as a reader, as well as a writer, that you're doing this work and consuming this overwhelming number of books out there. But think about, thank goodness, because think about, I would never want the opposite, right? You'd never want to feel like, gosh, you know, I guess I read all the books in the library. I'm done. I guess I can't go to the bookstore.
You know, my constant worry up until I started the bookstore was I didn't have enough to read. You know, where will I find this book? And now I'm drowning in them, but that's okay. You know,
one
of the other things that we really worked very hard on here is to look for independent press books, you know, to look for books that are not getting a lot of hype, a lot of support. The New York Times is not reviewing them, whatever. Sure. Because, you know, sometimes it's not the first book for an author. In fact, most of the time, it's not the author's first book. It's a later book that really takes off. Sometimes I think there's kind of a wisdom now that's like the seventh book in a series is really enough readers stick, you know, to kind of make it work. On the other hand, sometimes authors run out of gas at book five in a series because they've said all they have to say. So, you know, a question that you will have to answer is whether you are going to continue with these characters or if this is a standalone. You don't have to answer it. I'm not asking.
Yeah.
Or whether, you know, whether you're going to write something completely different, because I think some stories, let's take Gone with the Wind, for example. I never wanted to know what happened when she went back to Tara. Or Rebecca, when the house burned down, that's it, you know? And I think it's important for the author to recognize and not necessarily succumb to commercial pressure. So, oh, that did so well, you know, you should write these characters again. Mm. Only if you really are convinced there's a great story for these characters to continue, should you do that. Otherwise, you know, and there is a trend in domestic suspense to write standalones. Because it tortured your character. I'm not saying you did, but you know, generally putting people through that kind of pressure and with all the twists and so forth, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to do that to them again. Well, I really appreciate all the backstory. Patrick, come and pop in and see if we've elicited any questions or if you have any questions before we sign off.
Let's see here. There are a few questions here. However, I think you may have covered these. Robin would like to know, how long have you lived in the Santa Cruz area?
Yeah, I've lived in Santa Cruz Mountains for 16 years. That's right. I grew up in Los Angeles, and then I went to college on the East Coast. I met my husband in Washington, D.C., and we were living in downtown D.C., but we really wanted to get to the West Coast. He grew up very rural in Washington State. I grew up in Los Angeles, and we found this ex-commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's actually quite close to the Mystery Spot, which is one of those like optical illusion kind of tourist traps. But it's very funny because, you know, we've now lived by the Mystery Spot for 16 years. And it wasn't until I started writing mystery novels that people started being delighted by this, you know, this address, that this quirk of my address, that, you know, to be a mystery writer and living near the Mystery Spot. So we live up in the mountains, and we live off the grid, actually, in a small community. And Barbara, to what you were saying, you know, I have no idea if I'm going to write more with these characters or not, but I do know that there are a lot of quirks of the Monterey Bay that I would love to dive into. And one of them that I feel like I've had a lot of experience with is these weird hippie commune kind of places in the mountains, as somebody who lives around and in something like that and has really happily for the last 16 years.
Well, here's the thought, you know, you can center a series on a place. You don't have to center it on the characters. I mean,
that's interesting.
Other people living there. So
sure.
You know, you can leave them aside and you can bring in a new cast, but continue to explore it. I'm going to introduce your voucher con to my friend, Laurie R. King, fellow mystery writer.
Who lives I know in- her.
Oh, good. All right. And did you read Back to the Garden?
Yes, it was incredible. And it really made me think about, I used to run the Museum of Art and History in Santa Cruz. And so I had a lot of connection with Filoli and some of the kinds of places like the site of that. And Laurie was so generous to me. When I first started writing mysteries, I called the owner of our local indie bookshop, Santa Cruz, and said, you know, I want to meet this person, Laurie King. You know, she's such a superstar. Is there any way you could connect us? And Laurie was so generous in sort of laying out for me, these are the conferences, these are the, you know, and she really taught me a lot about this industry, which was, I'm so grateful for.
Oh, yeah, she's a super mentor. One of my very dearest friends. So I'm really
pleased wonderful.
To know her. Great. Carry on, Patrick.
That's really about it for specific questions. There's a comment, every time you drive by Elkhorn Slough, you'll see different birds, different dolphin sculptures on the hill too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here.
Oh. And I'll just say, I had a lot of fun working with not just, I have a friend who's a wildlife ecologist who helped me with some of the research, but also my mom and I, you know, Barbara, you mentioned earlier the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They put out a beautiful book in, I think, the 90s of the flora and fauna of Elkhorn Slough. And it's one of these, you know, nature illustration books where everything's beautifully hand-drawn and watercolored. And it just sort of became our research Bible, this book. And I'd go out paddleboarding and looking for these different animals and these different plants and trying to figure it all out.
You know, I used to, Marsha Muller, another California mystery writer you may have run into, used to write some books north of San Francisco and Mendocino or whatever it is. And I've always regretted that even though I did my undergraduate career in the San Francisco Bay Area, it was a lot harder to go there in 1958 than it is now. So we used to go up to Napa and whatever. We used to go grape stomping and stuff. But I've never been to Mendocino. And other than coming down all the way from Portland to Los Angeles on Highway 1 one time, but that, you know, doesn't do it. But I'm hoping that your book gets people to look at all these coastal communities or any
community
in point of fact. Ken Kruger's coming to see us on September 9th, has written a lot about the Boundary Waters, for example. Which is, you know, an incredible area, northern Minnesota with Canada and so forth. I like to hope that reading a lot of books like Mother Daughter Murder Night makes people more appreciative and more aware of you know, of places, whether they live there or visit them, and all the things. The flora and the fauna, whatever that goes with them.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as a debut novelist, I feel like I wrote this book for such an idiosyncratic reason for my mom. And I know that now, what a gift that this has turned into the next path I'm taking. And I don't know what I will be publishing next, but I know that I'm really committed to writing. And I feel like I'm just starting, you know, I'm proud of this book. I'm excited about this book, but I really feel like I continue to have so much to learn about the craft of writing crime fiction. And I'm just very excited to keep challenging myself and hopefully, you know, delighting readers and exploring all kinds of different ways to play in this crime fiction genre.
My experience is that the best writers are the people who grow through life going, what if? They go, what if? When they hear a conversation, they go, what if? When they see something, whatever. Curiosity is actually the biggest attribute, I think, of successful authors. Most of us sort of take things for granted when we see them, but the great crime writer goes, what if? Would you agree with that, Patrick?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And Patrick's a very distinguished editor of crime fiction. He's done a lot of great work and he's a critic as well. So anyway, we will look forward to having you at the Poison Pen in person. I will see you, if only at a distance, in San Diego.
I hope so.
She mentioned going, maybe not on screen, to VoucherCon, and I will remind you all that VoucherCon is the International Mystery Conference, named after Anthony Boucher, who was the New York Times mystery critic for many, many years, because it's a weird name. And if you don't know that, you'll wonder, why is it called BoucherCon? Next year, it's going to be in Nashville. It might be a little late to sign up to go to the one in San Diego that starts on Wednesday, but it's not too late to go to Killer Nashville, I think. No, that's a different small conference. Anyway, BoucherCon in Nashville. And there are small conferences, Left Coast Crime, and all over the country. So if you're a reader or a writer, or you're just curious, you could sign up for them. And it's a fellowship thing, but it's also a craft thing. And I encourage you to go. So
I have never been to BoucherCon before. This will be my first one, but I've been to Left Coast Crime and I learned so much. And I think that whether you're somebody who loves to read crime fiction or who is writing or aspiring to write, everybody is so friendly and you can really, I went to Left Coast Crime for the first time, it was 2 years ago when Mick Herron was the guest of honor, and I am obsessed with his books. And my only goal for the conference was to get to talk to him once. And I ended up, he was like the first person I saw. And I went up to him, this extroverted Californian, and he, this very nice, reserved British guy, and his wife just sort of accepted my enthusiasm. And I sort of stuck to them for the next 4 days, whether that was to their chagrin or their joy, but I learned so much, and it was just a peak life experience. And I just highly recommend going to one of these if you're a mystery fan, because everybody is so generous and so excited to talk to other people who care about this genre.
Wow, what a lead-in for me to say that Mick Herron, we will be talking to him on September 8th, the day after we talked to me.
But wait, he's not coming in person, is he?
No, I was just going to say, but John Sanford, one of our dear friends, is such a Mick Herron fan that he and Patrick and Mick and I are going to do the conversation, which I think will really be fun. But I agree with you. And I have to say, his new book, which is not a Slough House book, I love Mick before he ever wrote spy fiction. Mm-hmm. He's great other kinds of books. But this new one has maybe one of the best opening chase action scenes anyway that I've read in a long time. But what I really love is the sheer snark. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is so, and you know it's Boris Johnson. You absolutely know that the prime minister about whom he is snarking is Boris Johnson. So anyway, it's a great book.
I love his action. I love his humor, but I actually love his diction most. And when I heard that he had originally been a poet, it really made sense to me, because I think that nobody hits an image and then gets out of it with the kind of precision and restraint that he does. I think he's extraordinary. Yeah.
So Patrick, you're loving Mick's book. Do you want to chime in there?
No, I love the writing. That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, it's and he's such, as you say, Barbara, the snark is really great. But I love his sentences,
But he has a particularly British sensibility, at the way he goes at institutions and the rest of it. There's an author I'm currently reading called T.E. Kinsey, who is actually Mick Herron in 1912 with two women. And it's one of the best, now book 10. And it's published by Amazon in the UK and over here. And I live for these books because it's in its own way, it's sort of like Mick Herron, completely unexpected. The big theft is that of a custom bicycle seat, which leads in all kinds of ways about what did women actually wear to ride bicycles and how were the seats constructed so that women were not made miserable by sitting on them for so long, right? Who would know? I mean, I love it. Anyway, we've said enough. Thank you very much, Nina. Give your mom our best, and I will look forward to seeing you here.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. And I look forward to being there and with your puppy, who's been very good through this whole hour too.
He's out. I can hear him. Right. Bye.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.